spake openly in the world. I ever taught in the synagogues and in the temple, whether the Jews always resort, and in secret I have said nothing. Why askest thou me? Ask them which heard me, what I have said unto them. Behold, they know what I have said. And when he had said thus, when he had thus spoken, one of his the officers which stood by, struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, Answerest thou the high priest so? Jesus answered him. He said, If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why spitest thou me? Now Annas had sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Father, we do thank you for your word, and we ask that as we look at it now, that you would open it up to us, minister to us from it. Teach us, Lord, something more of your world, in the world in which we live, and how to apply it. We ask it in Jesus, your wonderful name. Amen. You may be seated. I've entitled the study this morning, The World of Deception. And here as we watch Jesus here in this exchange between him and Annas, the high priest, it's quite interesting to learn so much from it. I believe there's a lot in it. For in verse 19 it says, Then the high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. Now to put this a little bit in perspective as to what's going on, at this particular time in history, the Jews had lost their right essentially to govern themselves by Rome. They had been overthrown by Rome. They had been overtaken by Rome. They were subject to Rome. Now Rome left their own government in place, the Jewish government. They left the Sanhedrin in power and allowed the Sanhedrin to essentially run in their civil responsibilities, their civic duties, keeping their people together. Rome took the taxes. Rome had its power and its military in control and in force. They were subject to them. They just kind of ran their own cultural aspects of their nation, allowed them to keep their people kind of in line. And so they had a certain amount of authority. They had a certain amount of judgment given to them. But they had also been restricted greatly in the sense that they had no authority for capital punishment. They could not exercise the death penalty. That was to be done by Rome. Anytime they had a case amongst themselves, they could imprison each other. They could do other things there as they went about the daily issues of judgment and of ruling their people, keeping them in line, essentially, according to their own laws. Rome was fine with that. But there, when it looked there, when the capital punishment or death sentence was to be executed, then the Jews amongst the Sanhedrin, which was kind of its ruling authority, would then hold a case. They would then have their own sort of a trial after that they had gone through their trial and felt, hey, this requires the death penalty for what it is. They now had to take their case, go present it to the Roman authority that was there. And he, whether Pilate or Herod or whatever governor was in place, had sole authority to say, carry it out, let him die. Now, normally, that seemed to be the case in the sense that when they had gone through a case, Rome had no desire to exercise, you know, and to have any disputes with the people. And when the people came and said, here, this person's done this, they need to die, they would go along with it. For the most part, it appeared. And so, but they still had to have their final authority to do it and to carry it out. Well, here we have what is so interesting, I suppose, about this, is that here we have the high priest, who is now doing a most interesting thing, because at this time the high priest, there was literally, he was to be the judge in a case. And is that he was to be the judge, a judge is always to be impartial. That's very clear in Deuteronomy, in the Old Testament. A judge is to be somebody that simply like the way we still yet do our cases here, there is a prosecuting attorney, there is a defense attorney. They now come and present their cases. The judge is merely there to be an impartial person who just makes sure that they're presented correctly and is weighed out, and either the judge or if they happen to have a jury trial, the judge now looks and makes sure that impartiality there, and now the jury adds up the case as it is presented. The judge doesn't present anything for the prosecution or for the defense. He is merely there to see that it goes out honestly, clearly, and openly, and impartially. That is the high priest's job. But here we have an interesting thing in the sense that the high priest is not doing his job. He is actually here. He is asking Jesus essentially to testify against himself, which was contrary to their law. contrary to their methods of doing any form of judgment. A high priest was to be impartial and to sit there and to have it brought before him so that he could weigh it out and then decide if this did indeed need to go to Rome. But he was there to see that impartiality happened. But instead of it, he had already decided and was already essentially acting as, you know, judge, jury, and prosecuting attorney here himself. He is finding himself there questioning Jesus, act like a prosecuting attorney, asking him leading questions. Tell me about you and your disciples. Tell me about your doctrine. Tell me about the things that you believe and that you are doing. He is now already, you know, they're planning. We already know from the other scriptures that had already been predetermined by this point that the high priest, he was hook, line, and sinker in with it. Very clear from the rest of the gospels about this. But when this happens and now the high priest turns to Jesus, they're trying to build a case. Trying to add information there, you know, to try to get Jesus there so he can go to Pilate. He can go to Rome with it. So when he asked him these things, Jesus there, he really didn't care whether it was a judge or a jury or a high priest or a prosecuting attorney or a defense attorney. Jesus would tell anybody anything. We know that about him. Whatsoever. He never had any, well, I've got, now who's asking this? What's their motivation? How I, you know, have to work this thing through there as if I'm being tricked or some sort of a thing like that. What Jesus, and when he answered, he revealed so much about himself, for he said, I spoke openly to the world. I taught in the synagogue and in the temple where the Jews always resort, and in secret I have said nothing. Jesus looks at him, he says, anything you want to know about it, it's absolutely open. What I did openly. In secret, I did nothing. I had no secret agenda. And I had nothing going on with my disciples to overthrow the government, to overthrow you. Is that what you think? And here as he is looking at them, he says, that is not the case. Now at the time, there had been many other leaders that had come along that were so upset with Rome and that had tried to literally bring about an uprising. And that was a capital offense. To go against Rome and to try to build, you know, something to go to fight against them. But here now, Jesus had never ever done that. What Jesus taught, he taught openly, he taught publicly, and any and all of his private discussions were merely ones that explained what he had said publicly. There was never any difference between the two. What you got in public from Jesus, you got in private. What you saw in private was also there in public. There was no difference. He had no secrets, no hidden agenda. As a matter of fact, he even had to discourage his disciples and others from trying to get him to assume authority. Because he had such power, many other people, they tried to make him king. He fed the multitudes. They came, we want you to be king. He said, no way. Not like, well, let's wait till we got a few more here. Time's not right. No, he just flat every time. He did the exact opposite of it. And then when he did teach, my kingdom is not of this world. He was despised. He was rejected. That's what he taught about himself. He was going to be crucified. He had sought to discourage them constantly, you know, from thinking of any immediate kingdom to be set up. And even the Jewish leaders, because they picked up from the people the potential that Jesus could do this, the Jewish leaders from that, the Sanhedrin had earlier sent people to Jesus trying to set him up. Trying to get him to go against Rome. So that they could have a case. They came to him and wanted to know who he was. They attempted to trap him with an issue of paying taxes and of paying them to Rome. You remember the story. Jesus said, well, hand me a coin. Do you have one? They hand him a coin. He says, whose picture's on it? They said, Caesar's. He says, you render under Caesar that which is Caesar. You render under God's that which is God's. I have no conflict with Caesar. I'm not here to overthrow or do anything against Caesar. Every time that they had attempted to turn things, you know, if anything, it destroyed their case. There was absolutely no legitimate charge whatsoever they could file against him. So now we actually have the Sanhedrin and the high priest themselves, who ought to be the ones that are evaluating justly a case. We see them actually now bringing about a case, trumping up charges themselves. trying to get something to bring things before Pilate. And here is that they're attempting to do this. They even knowingly, when you see this, they went out and the Bible tells us they recruited false witnesses. Deceivingly, they go out and say, here, we have no case, so let's get some false witnesses, give them what they want them to go in and testify against so that they can get Jesus strung up. They can have him crucified. What a justice system. What a thing has gone on. What a thing here is happening. And yet, even Pilate, he was clever enough to know that when all this is happening and then the false charges are brought before him, he looks and as he examines the whole case, he says, I find nothing in this man. He's absolutely innocent. I can't have anything to do with this. He looked at them and he turned them down. He who by nature would just normally want to go along with the Sanhedrin, want to go along with the local government, want to just keep peace in the country. He says, wait a minute, there is no case here. You know there's no case. He's looking at them, no doubt, and wondering, why are you doing this to your own people? What in the world is your problem here? Why would you behave this way? But Jesus there, as they're trying to get him to implicate himself, trying to get him now to say something they can twist, that they can turn around. He turns and he says to him, he says, why do you ask me? You want to know what I said? He said, ask anybody. Ask anybody at all who ever heard me. There's where you form your case. There's where you form. Go see if you've got any witnesses out there who would say anything of me other than what is very well known to all. And Jesus, essentially, he ends up kind of taking the trial over into his own hand. The servant there, the high priest, ends up slaps him. Jesus turns. He says, well, if I've done something wrong, explain this to me. But if I haven't, why do you smite me? What's your problem? Truth got your tongue? I mean, he's looking at them, and here you do this. The thing that's so amazing to me is it's so interesting here to watch the behavior of Jesus and of Annas the high priest. And you realize as you look at this what a complete contrast there is between the two. On one hand, you've got Jesus there who is saying, ask anybody, anything about me, anywhere, whatever I've said, privately, publicly, ask them all. What I am in public, I am in private. What I am in private, I am in public. Oh, could you imagine the high priest even thinking of saying that? Imagine the high priest. They're being able to say, hey, you want to know anything about me? Ask anybody. Ask anybody in the Sanhedrin. Ask anybody up or down and around. What I am publicly, I am privately. Oh, he wouldn't dare do that. It's already recorded on how that they had privately already predetermined that one must die for everybody, Jesus. They had already predetermined. They'd discussed the case. The crowds were no longer following the Sanhedrin. They weren't listening to them. They were following Jesus in their envy and their jealousy of Jesus. They wanted them back. And from their perspective, they don't want to just sit there and say, hey, you want to know anything about us? Just check it out. Sure, we had a meeting. Decided you need to go. We want it where we're jealous. We want them back. And so we've already determined we're going to find a case presented one way or another, however we've got to do it, by hook or by crook, and we are going to get you out of here. You're going to die. We want them back. No, he wouldn't say that, would he? Wouldn't dare do that, so they had to do something else. Even though they knew there were no grounds, that had nothing to do with it. This is just what a man's got to do. What a man's got to do, so to speak. But here as you look at this, Annas, of course, there's no openness about him, is there? There's no honesty. There's no evidence. There's no integrity. He's trying to find some way to manipulate any situation that he can try to build what he knows all the way through and through is a false case. But scariest of all, I think, as you look at this, and this is what I want us to look at this morning together, is that how tragic it is in the sense to see here that here we have a man who is just seemingly moving around so comfortably in a world of absolute deception. A deceiver. A man there in authority. A man in leadership deceiving. Living this way in absolute deception. And this sort of a thing doesn't happen in a moment. It just didn't happen with, you know, that very hour as they find themselves standing. This doesn't happen in a day or a week or a month. This happens as something there. He grows up in a world of deception. Could you imagine they're seeing a person with integrity and honesty and morality and values and what they are privately and publicly and openly? They are all the time and in one day just going out doing something like this. No, they don't do it. This is a process of a world and a life in which they're living in. And there's something there you learn over the years how to do it, how to work, and how to deceive for your own advantage. And I think one of the greatest tragedies in our world today is that we are so much like this everywhere we go. In fact, I believe our world is even worse than it was then. We live in a world, we live in a society that is so deceived that the deception is so total that most of us don't even think in terms of deception any longer. Most of us live in a world where we don't even realize the constant form of deception that there is. I don't even think we initially comprehend, you know, in a sense, wonder, you know, the wonder of what Jesus said when he looked there and he said, what I am through and through. When Jesus was able to look at the world, he says, what I am openly, honestly, totally. Every thought, every deed, every word, every behavior, every action, every motivation of my life is public. I have nothing to hide. And yet they're also to realize that as fully as exposed to any and all, and to realize that it is all pure. It is all holy. It is all just. It is all good. It is all thoroughly consistent. I don't think we realize what a contrast that is to our world today. The world in which we live and on how difficult it is sometimes to live in that, to function in. But we live in a world of deception. I don't think, you know, you go buy a car, and God bless all of you wonderful, godly Christian car salesmen. We need more of you or somebody. So often you go buy a car and you get the, you know, want to go get one, but how many times do you have to listen to the salesman act as if he's not making a penny? We're taking a loss on this thing, but we'll make it up in volume, you know, somehow or another. Yeah, we're losing $100, but if we can sell 1,000 of these, think it through. Well, we're trying, you know, but I mean, you want to look there, but somehow or another, the dealerships are still in existence. Don't understand that. They're still here. The same time the buyer goes in, this is all I got. I can't afford another penny. And you look at the two of them, they're sitting there, human beings, consciously, telling each other entirely different stories. Well, both of them, and the way you do business is they're both deceiving each other and yet neither honestly being deceived, both knowing they're working with a deceiver. It's the way of the marketplace. Last time I went to buy a car a few years ago, I went to a dealership. And went into the dealership, asked him, went back and forth to see the best deal I could possibly get. I got that, and then the guy says, that's it, we can't, we're losing money. That's it, we're done. So I went on the internet. Somebody told me, hey, check it out on the internet. And on the internet, you could put in, you know, what you wanted, the exact car, and exactly what it was that I wanted, that I got the very best price for. He was now losing money, couldn't do any more. It was over $1,000 cheaper somewhere else. And they sent me back on the internet their bid down in Bakersfield. I could go get the car. I printed it out, took it over to the dealer. And he sold it to me for $1,000 less a day later when he was already losing money. How could he do this? I said, I'll either go down to Bakersfield and get it, but if I don't want you to lose any more, well, that's all right. We'll save you a trip, you know, or whatever. But you look at this world in which we live. You go to work and in business. And so often, every major corporation has got a top secret research and development department. Why? Because everybody wants to steal each other's secrets. How can you get in and beat the competition out of its own new product? Wherever you go, there's cheating, there's deception. Automakers are designing, you know, cars constantly under total wrap so that nobody else will get their design and get it out ahead of them. And advertising. You want to, every time you turn on the TV or look at something, watch how they advertise virtually anything. You want, you know, you see there's a car for sale, but the car is always sitting in front of an estate. Have you ever seen a car for sale parked out in front of a old trailer? No, I don't think so. I've never seen anybody have, and here's the deal you want. No, it's always in front of this beautiful estate, you know, with a circle drive, fountain out in front, lined with beautiful landscaping, and this beautiful blonde there with the keys to the car handing them out to you. As if to say, hey, you buy the car, you get the estate, you get the cobblestone driveway, the landscaping, and me. You know, somehow or another, I want the car. It's deception. It's the way that we go about doing business in our world today. It's the order of the day. A while back, I was speaking to a very troubled sales manager of a high-tech corporation who was told by the executives. Move everything you possibly can, all the sales, whatever you got to do to twist people's arms or whatever, over the next quarter or two, get them into this quarter if you possibly can. There were secret negotiations going on for the sale of the company, and the price that was going to be determined for the price of the corporation was going to be at the quarter's end reports and the stock price at that point. And so they know this is the negotiation. Get everything, you know, do whatever you got to do for the next two quarters. Let them die. We're selling the place. And get the very best you can in this quarter because we're out of here. I think that's deception. Particularly if I'm the buyer. You know, of the thing that realizes these are the world. This is, but today, this is just good business. Today, this is just the way it is. It's how you got to do it. You go into a supermarket. You buy a box of cereal. You come home, the box is half empty. Where'd my cereal go? Well, you think, well, today you can't go put a cereal in a box that it fits in. Nobody will buy it. It's half the size of everybody else's box in the place. So you fill it with air and sell a big box. It's marketing. It's how you do something. Deception. So all these little things in our whole world, we live in so much of it, we never even think about it. Why do we do this? Do the guys have extra cardboard they want to use? Hey, we got too much cardboard. Build a bigger box. You know, and let's send out bigger boxes. No. However we can present a thing. Can't even, you know, our world is built on it. Look at professional sports, any sport almost. Deception. I don't know how good or bad it is, but it's sure there. A football team. You go out and play football. What are you doing? You're trying your level best to deceive somebody. You go back in a huddle. All right. Let's make it look like it's going to be a run. You know, fullback, you go over here, go out to the side, look like you're going to block somebody, sneak out to the side, we'll throw a pass, we'll deceive them, and we'll get points, and they'll look stupid, and we'll win. And we'll get a lot of money for it. Let's play. You know, and everybody will think, look at them, they're the greatest deceivers in the world. Baseball, a guy gets up there like he's going to go for a home run, and what's he do? He gets everybody to back up, and then he hits a bunt and runs, and walks to the baseline. You idiot. I got you. And everybody say, oh. We just watched the NBA finals where the guys sit there, dribble the ball down. The whole thing is to look one way like you're going to go there. And when the guy makes the move, boom, you go the other way. Deceive him. Such, I mean, and it's fun. Whoever can, the best deceivers, best guys. Tennis player. Guy gets up there, the ball's coming, he's going with a shot right down the line, looks his eye, starts moving at it, pulls the guy over there, and then he dinks it over cross court. Oh, got him. Deception. It's just our world. It's just the one in which we live. And the other day I heard a fellow telling a story about how he's out jogging. And as he's jogging in the morning, he slowed down to a walk. But then as he just came around a corner, he noticed two girls walking the other direction. All of a sudden, he sucks it up, speeds it up, goes by briskly, jogging past them there. He can hardly wait to get around the corner so he can stop, catch his breath. Hey, I'm an athlete. For about 10 seconds, you know, or whatever else it is. But whatever we can do to look good, to be good. Deception. It's our marketplace. My wife, she gets dressed, she looks at me and she says, honey, does this look thinning on me? In other words, is this deceptive? Am I dead? But anyway. And then, of course, what do? I say, honey, you don't need anything thinning. You are. And she is. And I'm not going to get out of this one. But you look at our political world. I didn't want to need to go into that. Anybody that in a moment believes any longer, it's like you look at the political world, you look at our legal world, it's entirely seemingly built upon this. And the great tragedy of it is that a result of it is that wherever we go and whatever we don't know ourselves, we don't know each other, we don't know how to be honest, our careers, what we're doing. It pours into our job, it pours into our marriages, it pours into our homes. And it is such a contrast to Jesus' world. Because you see, Jesus, he telegraphed every thought, every behavior, every word, every plan, all open, all entirely free. And here it's something there, whereas the Lord watches all of this, and you see this contrast between the world of Annas and the world of Jesus, and you realize there the devastation, the deceptiveness brings upon a society. Because God looks at it, and obviously He hates it. You see, He watched Satan deceive Adam and Eve. He watched through deception Cain kill Abel. He saw through deception and on how Abraham took Hagar instead of his own wife to have a child with. He saw on how Joseph and Joseph's brothers turned against him. We're going to kill him, and then end up selling into slavery and then deceive their own father and just broke up their family. Send one off into prison. He saw deception and how it works. He watches it all the time. He sees what it does to homes and to marriages and to families. Everywhere, entirely through our society. He sees on how there's a world who's been deceived into thinking that there's other gods and there's other ways to live than His. While He Himself loves absolute, total openness, truth. Proverbs 14:25 says, "A true witness delivers souls, but a deceitful witness speaketh lies." You're essentially, if you're looking at trusting in anything else, then the Lord, you're in trouble. Isaiah tells us in Isaiah 44:20, says, He feedeth on ashes, a deceived heart that hath turned him aside, that he cannot deliver his soul, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? When a man becomes a deceiver, he can't deliver anybody. His own soul's in trouble, and he can't even say, there's not a lie in my right hand. What I'm actually doing is a lie. What I'm all about is inconsistent. It's not a truth. The Lord said through Jeremiah in Jeremiah 9:1, and listen to this for a moment. "Oh, that my head were waters and my eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people. Oh, that I had in the wilderness a lodging place of wayfaring men, that I might leave my people and go from them, for they are all adulterers. And an assembly of treacherous men. They bend their tongues like a bow for lies, but they are not valiant for the truth upon the earth. For they proceed from evil to evil, and they know not me, saith the Lord." God looks at entire society. And He says, "Yeah, I'm so broken when I look at this, the bending the truth like a bow, lying. You don't know who you are, what you're doing. There's no more valiant men with truth upon the earth. You proceed from evil to evil." And as He looks at them, He says, "The result of it is, I wish that my head were as waters, mine eyes a fountain of tears. I would weep day and night for you when I see your lives like this, and on how the evil that takes over." This last week on Fox News Network, and of course you can always take those however you want to, I suppose, but I saw an interview discussing the direction that the TV industry is going in. And there, as they were discussing it with this man on the network, he explained to them, he said that there is absolutely no question to anyone involved in the TV industry that the entire industry is moving rapidly towards full exposure pornography. They questioned, said, "Really? Was it already in Europe? It's already in England. And it'll be here very soon. It's just a question of if." It's not a question of if, it's just when. But the most amazing thing, as he was speaking, he says, "Well, don't you realize how big this is?" He said, "Well, I don't know if I do or not." And he said, "Well, let me give you an idea. Right now, there is more money spent on pornography than there is all professional athletics." Well, I'm sitting there thinking for a moment, and I just heard him say that. I said, "Wait a minute. I'm thinking, that can't be true. Are you talking bowling, ping pong, or something?" But then he went on himself to explain. He says, "I mean all professional athletics. I'm talking baseball, football, basketball, baseball." And when you sit there and realize the billions of dollars that are being spent this last week, who knows how many people sat and watched and took in the NBA finals. When you look there and realize they're like in professional motorsports now, I come to realize that is one of the largest attended things. They'll have 300,000-500,000 out for a single race of NASCAR or the Indianapolis 500. When you look at what is going on in baseball stadiums all around the country, the trillions of dollars that are being spent on athletics. The stadiums that are filled, basketball, baseball, football, tennis. When you look at the billions and billions and billions of dollars and realize that every time that there's a city that has 100,000 people sitting in a stadium spending the kind of money they are, there are more people spending more money deceptively, secretly. Pornography. Oh, they don't do it in public stadiums. They don't gather together with 100,000, 300,000 people. They don't go get a big screen TV, you know, so they can watch the pornography. But they're doing it. And the money that is there is driving a world into deception and hiding and guilt. It's taking them where they're living a double life and a double standard. And when you look at this, it's all underground. It's all secret. It's all private. People don't brag about, you know, getting a front row seat in a strip club. They don't brag about, hey, I got 50-yard line on a 52-inch screen pornography show. No. But behind the scenes, just as Annas is sitting there with Jesus in a world of deception, he doesn't even see it, know it. He is so taken over by it. He's entirely unaware that once he was the deceived and now he's actually the deceiver. And now his own life is in secret. Now he is carrying out in public what he is trying to hide in private. That's a plague in our world today. It's destroying marriages. It's destroying homes. It's destroying careers. It's destroying businesses. It's destroying our society. And God says, if my entire head and, you know, it was a river and was a fountain, day and night I would weep when I watch the deceptiveness and I see what it is that they're doing. In Jeremiah 9:4, he says, take heed, every one of his neighbor, and trust ye not in any brother. For every brother will utterly supplant, and every neighbor will walk with slanderers. Here now the Lord, he's looking at society and he has to tell them, he says, by the way, you are so deceived and you're deceiving each other so much in your lives and your homes and your families that you can't even trust your own family. You can't distrust your own family. He says, don't trust them. They'll utterly deceive you, one another. Why is he telling them not to trust their neighbor or their brother? Why? Because when he sells the car, he knew he was lying. When he was buying the car, he knew he was lying. That as far as God's concerned, you're selling it to your brother every time you're doing anything, whether you've ever met him before or not, whether you've ever done business with him or not, whether you've ever carried on a conversation or not. That is your brother. When you find yourself going to some questionable place or carrying on in some internet site, that is somebody there. That is your family, whether you've ever met them or not. And as messed up as their life may be, to end up supporting somebody there that God in heaven looks at and says, that's your brother, that's your neighbor, that's your sister, who you're to love and protect and care for. And yet now, look at the world in which you're in. God says, now he has to look at society. He said, don't trust each other. Don't listen to each other. You'll supplant each other. You'll take each other down. Why don't you do what, why does he say, don't go jack up the market price, move everything into a quarter? Because you're selling that business to your neighbor, to your brother. Though you never met them, and though they're just some big corporation that's just paying what they believe to be market price. What Jesus was, he was all the time, every moment of every day, every conversation he had. They were all as open and as loving with every human being, everything he carried on. There was no second level. He didn't sit there, well, you guys are my friends. We've got this little relationship, so I'll kind of do this with you, and then the rest of the world, I'll treat them this way. After all, I really never met him yet. He looked at every one of them, though they never met him. He loved them all. Jeremiah 9:5, he says, and they will deceive everyone his neighbor and will not speak the truth. They have taught their tongue to speak lies and they weary themselves to commit iniquity. Here literally now you get so much into deception that you literally train yourself to continue it. You have to teach yourself. You get to where you're really good. When your wife says, where you been? What you been doing? Next thing you know, you're already prepared for it. The answer is there. The deception, the iniquity, the lie is there. And you weary yourself. It is so tiring to have to do it. To have to plan. What am I going to tell the boss? How is this story going to fix with something he may be able to check out there and to verify? What am I going to tell my wife? What am I going to tell my parents? What am I going to tell my children? What am I going to tell my neighbor? And we weary ourselves teaching ourselves what to say. Psalm 52 says, why boastest thyself in mischief, O mighty man? The goodness of God endureth continually. thy tongue devises mischief, like a sharp razor working deceitfully. Thou lovest evil more than good and lying, rather than to speak righteousness. Thou lovest all devouring words, O thou deceitful tongue. He looks there and a man actually gets so far into this that one day he's devising mischief, doing it so deceitfully that he ends up actually loving that world he has moved into more than honesty. And when he even could be honest, and when the honesty wouldn't even bother, he still wants to keep up the craft, there Psalm says. He will still go on with evil more than good because he wants to stay in practice. He's good at it. Jeremiah 9:6, he says, thine habitation is in the midst of deceit. Through deceit they refuse to know me, saith the Lord. Here the Lordly looks. He says, you see what deceit has done? He looks at all of Israel and he says, this is what's happened to you. You live in it, all of you, every day. Don't even realize it. Don't even know it. You've grown up in it around and it's just a man's got to do what a man's got to do. You're in the marketplace, that's how you do business. You're over here, that's how it is. There's a cute girl at the office, here's how you carry on with her. You're off on a business trip and here's what can go on. And here's the club you can visit or here's the thing you can do. And you find yourself living in a world so unlike Jesus. As he looks at this, Jesus never had to deceive or to bend or to twist or manipulate or to hide. But nor does a Christian that trusts in God. Never, ever in all of life do you and I have to do this. Anybody that has to deceive in any way to get a job or a house or a car or a wife. We deceive. I mean, our society, we're hilarious. I look at our whole dating procedure. Talk about deception. Boy meets girl. Wants to take her on a date. Asks her out. And then he does the most amazing things that his mother has watched him for years, never got him to do. He takes a bath. He puts on ironed clothes, washed, clean. He washes the car, opens the door for the girl, helps her in, takes her to a nice restaurant, and tells her how delicious the lobster is. The world is looking, hello. And she's there saying, whoa, I think I like him. Meantime, she spent all day put on 17 outfits, trying to figure out what to wear. Didn't like any of them, rushed off the last minute to the mall, got herself a new outfit. He comes over, picks her up, says, you look nice. She says, oh, this old thing, I just threw it on. Whoa, you always look this good. Whoa. And they fall in love on that basis. Let's get married. Let's do it. Now, if we can just keep lying for the next 50 years, we'll be all right. But when you look, and your life is built on that. Here there's something, because every time we do these things, we sin against God. Break his heart. You don't have to do that. And trust me, we break down our trust and our love and our dependence upon him. We weaken it. We corrupt it. We destroy it. And then one day, as we're destroying our own character, our own nature, exhausting ourselves, then one day you wake up in a world, as Jeremiah 9:6 says, as thy habitation is in the midst of deceit. And through deceit they refuse to know me, saith the Lord. One day you wake up and you live in downtown Deceitville. And everywhere you go, it's carried on. And the worst part of it is, we don't even know it. We've learned to function in it so clearly. But the wonderful thing is, it doesn't have to be that way. The wonderful thing is the whole reason Jesus came into the world was to take that tax collector that had deceived to make a living, ripping off people, Matthew, to set him free. The reason he came into the world was to take that woman who'd been, you know, living the life of in prostitution or adulteress, thinking that initially it was pleasurable, now it entirely entrapped her, destroyed her, and to set her free. There to take that man who found himself caught up in the internet and he can't get out of it. And it's got a power and a pressure and a deception. And he realized he lives in two worlds and he's now making up, practicing stories to carry on. Where he's spending his time and his money, finding his pleasure. And he's going into a world that he's actually beginning to wake up and realize, I love evil more than good. And Jesus said, I came to get you out of it. I came to set you free. Came to absolutely transform you. We're all born this way. We're all born deceived and deceivers. That's the nature of sin. But the wonderful thing is that Jesus knows this. He knows we're caught. He knows the power of it. And how I believe he just wants to have us one day know that he loves us. I read earlier Psalm 52:1, where he talks there, you know, about your tongue lying and deceiving and making mischief and loving evil more than good. But his first question that I just rapidly ran through, he says, "Why boastest thou in mischief, O mighty man? The goodness of the Lord endureth continually." Here he looks at him and he says, "You don't have to do that. God's goodness can set you free anytime at all. You can tell the truth." One of the most wonderful stories in all the Bible to me is the woman that was caught in the act of adultery. Or the woman at the, or her too, but also the woman at the well, who'd had five husbands, and Jesus told her, "You've had five. The one you now have isn't yours either." But there's, he loved her, and she realized he knew all of this, and he still loved her. "You know I'm caught in this web. You know my life. You know my behavior, and yet you still seek me out and love me." She was so astounded by it. He said, "Of course, with all my heart. I'm here to set you free." And she was set free, so much so she ran to town, and it said she told the men, can you imagine this? "Come see the man who told me all I ever did." Is that a free woman or what? Deception's gone. Can you imagine the men say, "Beg your pardon?" "Say what?" They knew. And now she is so free of it, she's able to run. Set free. Jesus did that for me. You know, as we close today, I believe the Lord wants to look at you. Maybe some of you in your marriage, there's deception. Your career, your deception. The way you do business is deception. The way you just carry on, it's just, it's everywhere. It's the world. And you're absolutely convinced, well, hey, it's the only way of survival. It isn't. It isn't at all. But to be able to come and say, "Lord, in my home, in my marriage, in my family, in my career, whatever it is, to be able to look at somebody, set me so free, Lord, I can just look at who I am and what I say in public and what I am in private and what I'm about and what I do. I am through and through. No other motives." Wouldn't you love it? You can have it right now. That's the power of Jesus. And to be able to come and say, "Lord, set me free." Maybe some of you, you're caught up in the web. You're caught up in a world of deception. You know the difficulty of the stories. Maybe some of you, you're carrying on, flirting. Maybe you've got an affair. The guilt. Hopefully, the guilt is still there. Hopefully, there's something that says, this is wrong. In such a way as you can turn and realize, you don't have to give in to it. Say, "Jesus, set me free." That's how powerful he is to transform you. Isn't that wonderful? Lord Jesus, how we do thank you for your word and your love. And Lord, we thank you that you think this way. You are this way. And Lord, you love just to simply take our lives and say, "Would you like to be free? Would you really like to be free? Because I'd love to set you free." And Lord Jesus, I pray that this morning, that any of us that have another world, whether it's one in our own heart or our own thoughts, that what we are in public, we're not in private. And how we think and what we desire and the world in which we live, we're absolutely scared to death that one day it'd be exposed. And Satan actually has us thinking we have to keep it quiet. We have to hide it as best we can and hope it never gets found out. But Jesus, I thank you that you come to us and say, "I know all about it. And I love you. You're my child. I know the world in which you live. I understand it. I know what it's done to you and now what it's trying to get you to participate in what you're doing. And I have no greater joy than never to condemn you, but to come and love you." say, my greatest joy is to change you. Not break you down, but pick you up. Say, would you like to follow me? I'll set you free. Jesus, I pray that we would know this world and that we would find ourselves in it. And that today that we would realize as we just turn to you. And Lord, maybe some of us in our marriage, it's inconsistent, to say the least. Our desires, Lord, I pray that you would help us today in our families, in our businesses, the things we say that to our neighbor, to our brother, though we don't, maybe don't think of them that way. You sitting in heaven, you do. You say, well, you don't know them by name, but wouldn't you love to have them be your brother, your neighbor? Lord, help us that we don't cause you to weep in our own lives, to break down. So Jesus, we pray that today that we would just turn to you and that you would make of us men and women of integrity and freedom, and that you would cleanse us and forgive us, wash it away. And Lord, help us if there are things that we maybe have going on in our life that we even need to go and break down and destroy. Cut them off. Relationships that are not of you, to be done with them entirely. To be set free. So that we can one day look at you and the world around us and say, well, if you want to know anything about me, ask anybody. They'll tell you. Lord, how we would love that. So take your word today and strengthen us with it. For Jesus, we ask it in your wonderful name.